So before we begin the session this morning, let's take a moment to connect with the motivation that brought us here to the Abbey. And really rejoice when you look back on all the effort that you put in preparing for your time here. Had to make arrangements for your apartment or your pets, take time off work, plan months or weeks in advance. To really appreciate that part of yourself that cherishes your spiritual aspirations enough to put all that effort into coming here. Let's appreciate too all the people who made it possible for us to come here and practice. Maybe there are specific people who are covering your work, people who might have contributed to your airfare, but we can also extend that to think of all the people who donate the food that we eat every day. People who build these buildings, all the strangers who drove cars and planes so that you could get here. Really appreciating the intention that we have set for ourselves in coming here and all this incredible support we receive to do our practice. We can cultivate a very vast motivation for our time this morning, wishing that whatever we do will help us to repay that kindness of others. That by transforming our minds, we'll be able to develop our good qualities and extend that kindness that we've received to every single being that we connect with. With that in mind, let's spend a bit of time this morning sharing and discussing some of the Buddha's teachings with the intention to transform our minds for the benefit of all beings. So this morning I was thinking about how amazing it is that out of, what, 7 billion or more humans on this planet, 5 of you are here for Young Adult Program this week. Yeah. Just how incredibly rare and precious that is, that, you know, especially for young adults at a time when you are kind of in an economically vulnerable place, I would say, right? You don't have a lot of savings. You're trying to figure out school and work and life. And so to take 1 week off to come to a monastery in the middle of nowhere, I think it's a really big deal. You know, and from talking to you yesterday, briefly, what little I know of you, what I found very moving was that all of you are here with this very sincere wish to discover how best to benefit others. Yeah, some of you are going to school for that, right, trying to figure out, like, okay, what does the textbook say about how to benefit people? Some of you have given it a try already, you know, creating nonprofits, trying to reach out to people. Some of you are working on your motivation inside. So, you know, that's the first thing I think that's really important to keep coming back to and rejoicing in this week. That this is a very rare and precious group of young people, and that you're all here with the best of intentions. Yeah, nobody is here trying to learn how to make $1 million in 1 week, right? Or I don't know, how to be an influential so-and-so, yeah? So, you know, this is rare. Out of 7 billion people on this planet, the five of you, I'm counting the other, and you, six then, seven, five, are here together, yeah, with this most amazing of intentions. That's something to celebrate already, I think. And just thinking about that too, you know, like, what does the textbook tell us about how to benefit people? What does it tell us?
You ask me?
Yeah.
I don't know, I guess it's always, I've just noticed it's always kind of the same thing, like, you know, just grow up and make money and be happy and kind of the American dream kind of thing. Textbook, like, my textbook, right? Like,
oh, okay. So your textbook said grow up, make money, get the American dream, and that will somehow benefit others.
Yeah.
Okay. Were there other textbooks out there? Was there an Australian one?
I guess if you want to benefit others, you go to school and you learn to be a nurse or a doctor or something on those lines.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So educate yourself in a helping profession.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's what I see people have done. Mm. What was the Singapore textbook? Was there one? Buy a car, get a house, somehow that will benefit the world. Mexican textbook, Colombian textbook.
I think it's the same, but I just realized that maybe it's because we're still in developing countries. But I was thinking of the question before answering. It says you have find your economic stability and give to others, but not get them to the same status. So just give a little bit so they don't get too starving or something like that. It's pretty much what they say, you know, like you have to grow up, go to college, and have a good job, and get a little bit if you can.
So be very successful and give a little bit, but not so much that others are better than you.
Yes, pretty much that is what they say, you know, if you actually pay attention, it's like giving a little bit so you feel good with yourself, because that's what you do when you give. Sometimes to the homeless, like money, you're making more of that for you than actually giving something to the world, no? Mm. So that's pretty much.
Is there a German one too?
The German textbook, the most common, maybe the same. Mm-hmm. My textbook never had been like that. I always wanted to do something for people and to find a sense. Yes, but the common textbook might be the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. So we have people from all over the world here, but somehow we're all studying the same textbook, right? Telling us that somehow happiness is somewhere out there. Yeah, if we go to school, if we get the right job, if we find the right partner, if you make a certain amount of money and buy a certain kind of car and a house and also help your friend, but not too much, somehow you will be happy and the world will benefit. True or not true? Obviously no, but somehow that's still out there.
Huh?
Yeah, but we're here because we found that that doesn't really work. And so let's talk today a bit about the Buddhist textbook. Then, I mean, there really isn't a book. But the Buddhist approach begins in the total opposite way. As you know, the textbook starts with, if you want to benefit someone, it starts with your motivation. And that's the first thing we come back to check up, like, what's going on inside? Who am I trying to connect with or benefit and why? Yeah, and that's something we come back to again and again. You'll see here at the Abbey, those of you who've been here for a while, and every single thing we do, every single day, we keep saying, generate our motivation, generate our motivation. Yeah. And according to Buddhist philosophy and principles, our motivation, what's going on in our mind, is what determines the value of what we do. And not how much of it, not how many, how big, but really the quality of our mind that's engaged in the activity or the action that we're doing. That's what will determine the long-term result of our actions. So, you know, that's something for us to all check up. Yeah, as the Buddha always said, don't take what I taught on face value. Right, listen to it, reflect on how it works in your personal life, and check up. Is it true? Like, if you've given something very big, does it necessarily make you happy, or does it have more to do with your inner experience? So one example that Venerable Children often gives that I think really helped me to understand this idea was just a very simple example of what happens when we give to charity. Yeah, so for instance, let's say any one of us, yeah, you're working and there's a charity that represents values that you really believe in. They do work that you think is very beneficial for the world. And the easiest way to contribute sometimes is to give a donation, right? So, you know, whatever amount you're making, you save up every month a little bit, yeah? And then when you give with a very sincere wish, right? Like whatever amount, maybe $10, $20. And your wish is, you know, I believe in this organization. May they continue to do the good work that they do. May they continue to benefit people. I don't ask for anything in return. I just want to give to support so that they will survive in the world. Yeah. Have all of you given in that way before? Yeah? Was it a good feeling?
That's the trap, isn't it?
Oh? If you're looking for a good feeling,
that's the trap. So you've got to try and drop that.
If you're expecting necessarily to have a good feeling, yeah, it can be a trap. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with acknowledging when we give freely to something we believe in, and we see that the money is used in a beneficial way. It's like, oh, great. You know, you're doing something in line with your values. There's something to really rejoice in.
I guess I wasn't very clear. I mean, you puff yourself up. Aren't I good? You know, I've just given to charity. That's the feeling I mean to avoid. But yes, just a genuine good feeling that you've actually helped someone. That's,
so that gets tricky. Yeah, and that's the other kind of giving we'll get to. Yeah. I wanted to just say not to discount that kind of free giving, because it can have a huge inspirational effect. When thinking about this, there was a woman who used to contribute to the Abbey. Now she is in India learning Tanka painting. But back then we were building this building, Chenrezig Hall, that you see. And how everything gets built at the Abbey is based on other people's generosity. All of you have helped to build the Abbey in some way. And when we were calling for funds and all that, this woman was on disability here in the U.S., and she just saved whatever she could, you know, and then I think donated $10 every few months. Yeah, but she kept doing it over time to just support the building of this building. And she saved up so that she could come for the opening of Chenrezig Hall. Yeah, do you remember meeting her? Yeah. So, yeah, Heidi comes all the way. She saves all this money. She's been giving and giving, and she comes. And she just tells this story of how it really didn't matter, like, how difficult it was. She was, like, struggling to make ends meet and get enough food. But because she believed in what was happening here, and she so wanted to be part of it, she just saved whatever she could and then gave to support this building. And just hearing that story, I think, inspired all of us, so you still remember it. All the monastics were like, wow, that's really amazing, sincere practice. So it really didn't matter what amount she gave. Like, just the sincerity of her motivation inspired all of us, and till today it has this powerful impact. And now it's impacting you, right? Knowing that there's so many people like Heidi who saved up whatever they could to, so that we have this building that we can eat in and practice in and, you know, continue to keep going for others. Yeah. So when I thought of that, I thought, wow, that's the value of a very sincere motivation. It just has a long-term effect that we can't even imagine sometimes. Yeah. So of course, the clear converse, right, is of the example Venerable sometimes gives too, then, is of someone who, say, gives a huge amount to a charity, like $1 million. Yeah, but they have that motivation of, I hope they name the auditorium after me. Maybe they'll build a bronze statue of me and put it in the front, the Tubden Damcho Auditorium. And when all these people come, they're going to see, or you know, in some places.
Or to pay less taxes.
Yes, for the tax break.
I was going to do that, so I don't have to pay so much tax.
Yeah, but you know, but even more, it's not just some small benefit like taxes. Like, may everybody who comes to this charity now see my bronze statue and remember that I contributed this whole wing to the hospital, the Dr. Lee wing, or, you know. And that's a whole different motivation, yeah? That you may give $1 million, but the quality of mind is just totally focused on the self, right? Not so much on, there may be some benefit to others, but the whole mind is just concerned with, what am I getting out of this? Yeah. A tax break? Yeah. Are they going to honor me? And what happens if they don't?
You kind of regret giving. Why
did I even give that? Yeah, man, why did I give to this charity? You know, I should have given to the other one where they put your name in gold on the... Right? Then the mind gets so small. Yeah, it's, who cares if it's $1 million? Your mind just is still stuck in this miserable, unhappy place, right? That's like, how come they didn't honor me, and I gave so much and they got nothing in return, and I should really not help other people, and So when you compare that, externally, whatever amount people give, the real value is in the motivation. And you can see the difference in the impact of the motivation of giving. Right? Yeah. So that small, small mind that just makes us stuck, you know, in trying to get something back for ourselves is actually not our friend. Yeah. It's actually a source of difficulty, and it can make us regret our very virtuous actions. Most unfortunate. So that's why a big part of our practice here is to just keep checking up what our motivation is. Because we find that, I mean, do you find that you, with everything you do, it's like, yes, let me give freely, I'm happy. No. What other motivations do you have in the Bodhisattva?
Often I just find myself going on automatic. Uh-huh. It can be which I think coming in certain school systems and work, it's just, okay, next task. Performance based, just we'll do this, and mm-hmm. So I'm not even connecting in with why I'm doing it or how I'm doing it. It's just okay, get this one done, tick. Mm-hmm. So it might not necessarily be a negative motivation, but it's just absent. Mm-hmm. And so I can kind of get to the end, and there's a bit of a hollow feeling of just I just lost myself through the last 3 hours. Where was I? Because mm-hmm. I wasn't really present. I was just doing.
I'm guessing many of us have that experience, yeah, in whatever we do every day, you know, if it becomes rote or we're not present with it or thinking like, why do I do what I do? Yeah, because there isn't actually anything we have to do except to die. Everything else we get some kind of choice. I mean, you don't have to pick up your kids after school. but yes, we already know the consequences. It may be difficult, and you could send someone else. You know, tell them to walk home. But in everything we do, instead of being like, oh man, gotta pick up the kids. Oh, such a chore, right? It's like if we pause and say, I have a choice here. I love my child. I want them to be safe. Maybe this is a time for us to connect. Then you go do the same thing, like the whole activity becomes different, right? It's not like, now get in the car. It's like, oh, hi, I'm so happy to see you. You know, you're safe. How was your day in school? Let's go. Yeah. So I think our practice here, that's how we can start bringing it back to our daily lives. That's what we were talking about at breakfast, right? Just the simple action of checking what our motivation is. Why am I getting up today? What's the first thing I want to do? Does anyone actually remember the first thought you woke up with this morning? Oh yeah, that's usually mine too. I'm late. Other thoughts this morning?
It's too early.
Another 10 minutes of sleep.
It's raining, I miss the sun.
good. At least we were aware of the first thought. Someone who really changed the way I wake up. I mean, there are certain ways we try and wake up here, right? Every morning we try and wake, every morning at the morning motivation, we say we try and wake up with, as far as we can, a good aspiration. It takes a lot of training, yeah? So every morning you'll hear one of the monastics say, we really do, we try and wake up with the first thought, may I not harm any being today with my body, speech, or mind? May I be of benefit to all beings with my body, speech, and mind? And may I generate an altruistic intention to become awakened for the benefit of all beings. So, you know, it's one thing to hear it and you try and do it. But yeah, most of the time my motivation is some kind of panic habit from the past. But someone who really helped me with this waking up practice was actually my first roommate when I moved here. Her name is Zopa. I think some of you may know her. And she survived cancer. And she was a long-term resident of the Abbey. So every morning when she woke up, or she told me even in the middle of the night when she woke up, she would immediately think, oh, maybe I'm in my next life. Because she knew that could be possible anytime, yeah, with her illness and growing old. She woke up and, oh, okay, I'm still in this life, then she'll take refuge. So, you know, with that always present with her, I thought, wow, you know, I don't wake up like that. So hearing how she was practicing inspired me to start to just check up, what's my first thought? And how can I turn it? Even if the first thought is, or can I have some tea? Or, you know, like, let's see what we can do with this first thought of the day. Yeah. And that really helps us to see what's important that we need to work on. Yeah, because so often our first thought might be, okay, I have these things to do, and after meditation I need to talk to so-and-so nun, right? But really, and again, it's so hard to believe this, yeah, but that the most important things that we want to do in our day are not to harm anyone, to try and benefit others, and to do something that contributes to our spiritual life, yeah, that contributes to our potential to become awakened. That's the most important thing. I don't know. I still struggle with that too, you know. Often I think, yeah, the most important thing is to make sure you do the breakfast dishes on time. Or make sure you finish it. It becomes funny in a monastery, right, where there's like no money involved and you see your mind makes like super important things that really sound quite silly. Like, I must talk to so-and-so nun because they are doing this the wrong way. It's like, really? Is this really so important? So maybe you catch that in yourself too, right? It's like, oh, I can't stand it. So-and-so, their alarm clock goes off at this time. The most important thing today is to tell them to turn it off. Or, so-and-so, they breathe really loudly in the hall. I must tell them to breathe small, stop breathing, or whatever. So it's really interesting. That's a big part of the value of coming here too. You get to see what your mind imagines to be so important. And to check up if that's the case. Yeah. And whenever you can, to remind yourself to come back to those three motivations. You know, not to harm, be of benefit. And to do something that contributes to your full potential. And I would think some days, maybe what you do is not something that's outward directed. Right? Some days, maybe what you need to do is to do something for yourself. Or to work on your own mind. Yeah? Really depends on the day. So I find it so helpful to have these three motivations to check in with. Some of the more senior nuns too, like sometimes I ask them, like, how do you know what you need to meditate on today? Yeah, in your practice. Like, it's silent time up here. So many of them say, depends on what thought I wake up with. I wake up, I see where my mind is. Some days you wake up and it's like, just foul mood for whatever reason. Then you know, okay, something's coming up. That's what I need to bring to my meditation session. That's what I need to work on today. Maybe I won't pack my schedule with so many things. Maybe this is not the day to tell so-and-so that they need to change this because my mind's not in a good place. You know, so just to shift around what's going on for us that day and to take care of our mind is actually the most important thing. Right? True or not true?
True.
Then what gets in the way?
Our mind.
Still the mind.
She comes in the way.
Really? How?
Oh, I tried for a while someone else told me. The first thing they when you wake up is say, whoever is there, no? Mahoma, Jesus Christ, whoever it is, whatever you believe, say, oh, thank you, because I am alive, and namaste. And sometimes I just saw the first day, time, and later I realized, oh, sorry, go back again, oh, namaste. First, my mind goes right to the time to see if I wake up on time. Either when I, the night before, I say, oh, this morning, I am going to wake up and say thank you first. But the clock is right in front of me, so I just open my eyes and say, oh, okay. So either if I try, like, just go the other side. I don't know how, but it does.
So you're saying, like, often it's habit, right, that can get in our way, right? We have this wonderful intention. I'm going to wake up with a grateful thought. I'm late. Maybe you just put the post-it on your clock. But yeah, so you see, whatever we habituate ourselves to is what we're going to go towards, right? It's like if you walked on a path for a long time, then there's a path in the grass. So anytime you want to start a new habit, you're making a new path, right? So that just takes some time. Yeah. But I think too, so as you watch your own mind and you see what comes up, that also helps you to see what habits you have from the past. Like for instance, we would say too from past lives, if you're a Buddhist and you believe in that worldview, that these thoughts are not coming up randomly or by accident. These are thoughts we've become familiar with, whether in this life or in past lives. And these are, it's like that road in the grass. You know, we've walked this road before. Sometimes many, many times. Right? And that's why our mind tends to go in that direction. So some of those thoughts might be beneficial. I think some people find from a young age, maybe you have a lot of love for animals or others, right? So that's past habituation. Or some people you find that you tend to think negatively or be fearful or suspicious. Same thing. Habit from the past. So the good news is, we can change our habits. Yeah. Once we start to recognize them, once we start to see, oh, I've walked this way in the grass. Where is it taking me? Do I want to keep walking the same way? Then there's the chance that we can start finding different paths through the grass, right? Like you're doing. So you're telling yourself the night before, I will wake up and say thank you for being alive. You try, whoop, you went back the other path, but now you're saying, whoop, I'm going to back up. I'm going to start the new one. Let's try again. Thank you, I am alive. And as you do that again and again, then that new path gets stronger, right? And then you're creating new and positive habits. And that's why we meditate. Like the root word for meditation in Tibetan means to familiarize. So we're familiarizing our minds every single day. But now that we have a spiritual practice or we do a formal meditation, we're not familiarizing ourselves with the old textbook, right? Of, oh yeah, make money. Yes, make money. Oh, buy a car, buy what? Instead, we're turning inwards and we're trying to familiarize ourselves with something totally different. Say thank you first thing in the morning. Decide not to harm people. Try and be of benefit. And that takes a long time to start changing our habits. Yeah. What else gets in the way?
How about just like your emotions, how you were saying how sometimes you just wake up and you're kind of like in a bad mood and you don't really know why? I mean, sometimes I feel like that. Like logically, I know that I should be happy or grateful for today, but I just like am moody, you know? So it's like, I'm trying to figure out like, where does that come from? Like, why am I waking up not feeling that happiness, that I don't know, it's like I'm setting too high of an expectation for myself. I don't know. I'm still kind of like, I've been really thinking with that one.
Hmm.
You know, because to me, usually like mornings I wake up pretty good, but it's kind of like midday I kind of find myself being a little bit more like down or irritated. And so I'm just trying to say like, how come I know logically what I should do, but it's like I have like the intellectual maturity, but not the emotional maturity. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah, I think a lot of our practice too is like we'll hear the teachings, right? So there are three steps in all the teachings that we hear. Yeah, we hear them, and then we think about them in our analytical meditation, and then we offer service, and we figure out where we are, and then finally we try and really integrate them in our lives. And that's a long process that takes time. But do other people have that experience? You just wake up and you don't know where that mood came from.
Yeah.
Like why? Where?
Like, and sometimes nothing happened before, like the night before, you just wake up not feeling, wanting to see people or talking to certain people, it just happened. Okay.
That might be...
Actually, that's where the silence is really good, because you can't do anything at that point or play it out or anything. You have to be silent, and then you actually get to think about it and pull back a little bit. So that silence in the morning is actually really, really helpful.
Because what would you have done?
Well, I'm a little bit older now, so I don't react anymore. But at home, I wanted to keep quiet. But it's just that we've got this extended silence that goes on, and it's enforced, and it's just really nice space to work with your own feelings and moods. Because you do wake up those moods and feelings and go, oh, where did that come from? So you just have to work with it. You can't do anything, react in any way, because due to the silence is what I found. It's quite good.
So on this topic, I would say, you know, as you come here, like you say, in the silence, and we slow things down, I think then you'll get to start to see a clearer picture of what contributes to those moods, you know, as you study your mind. Yeah, there's no one answer for each of us, right? For me, I would, actually, when I finally wake up with the, it's been building for a while, often. You know, I've just been but caught in automatic, maybe, you know, like one too many nights of stay up late and push, and then finally 2 weeks later, you know, and I see, oh, that's like a really old habit I've had my whole life. I just don't pay attention to it. And here I am with this apparent lousy mood that's out of nowhere, but actually it's been building for a while. So that's something you can start to study in yourself, you know, or you find, why is it always after lunch? You know, is it that I woke up this morning with a certain bunch of expectations of myself, and now it's 2 p.m. and 12 hours are left and I'm a failure in life?
No.
Like, I'm such a failure. I got through number one. This is a lousy day. And then from 2 p.m. onwards, I'm a failure. You know, so here, apart, now that we have some space from our daily lives, we get to see these habits we carry with ourselves, right, that we don't even notice. Because you just think it's normal. Right. Yeah, of course everyone wakes up with a to-do list, and of course you're a failure by 2 p.m. if you didn't accomplish all five things. Yeah, so you catch these habits and you get to say, true or not true. Yeah. But you know, it's not just the states of mind that sometimes we don't seem to have any apparent control over. Right? You wake up and you're in a lousy mood. But what really touched me about Buddhism and what brought me into this practice was also seeing how, especially the Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, work with circumstances outside of their control. Yeah, because we know the history of Tibet, right? So they didn't wake up one day with a lousy mood. Like when you hear from some of the geishes or the teachers who escaped from Tibet, they're up studying one night at 2 in the morning, they look out the window, and His Holiness's palace is being bombed. Like, what next? So this is one teacher, Geshe Thapke, who's 84, and he came to the abbey to teach. And I remember his story was, they study all night, yeah. So he's studying at 2, quiet, looks out, oh, His Holiness's palace is being bombed. What's the first thing you do? Put these holy texts into some kind of bag or transport vehicle, get some barley flour and your bowl, go. Take your students, escape to the mountains. And initially, they all went out there thinking, we're going to come back very soon. But as we know, that was not the case, right? So then they started this long journey on foot across mountains, fleeing for their lives, crossing like really treacherous conditions, starving almost to death, and finding their way to refugee camps in Nepal and India. And that's how they survived. And through that whole journey, I don't think any of them complained. And I think some of the most remarkable stories, the one that I found most touching, was a story by a monk named Paulden Gyatso. The book is called Fire Under the Snow. And Venerable Trajan met him when he taught here in the U.S. But he was a prisoner of war. I think he remained in Tibet and eventually was arrested and put in prison and suffered all kinds of torture and eventually managed to escape and tell his story. And when he met with His Holiness the Dalai Lama asked him, "What were you most afraid of when you were in prison?" And he said, "Yeah, I was afraid I would lose my compassion for the people who were torturing me." Yeah. And too, we hear so many stories of these great masters who, you know, the prison guards would come and knock and, you know, open their door apparently and say, "Okay, you can go now." And they would shut the door and say, "I'm doing retreat. I'm still doing retreat. You can go." So, you know, and there were stories too of monks under house arrest, so they couldn't talk to people. They just spent the whole time doing retreat. They had no rosary, the mala, so they just counted mantra on their fingers. And he said they watched the sun to see how many hours of retreat they had done. So no matter what the external circumstance, they had trained their mind to a point where they had all these tools, right? Bad mood in the morning, they have tools to shift it. Bombing, have to evacuate my country, apply those same tools. I mean, that's not to say, I'm sure there was distress and sadness and fear, but as that came up, you know, they had practiced, they had walked the other path of compassion, of love, that they could put into practice. They immediately could turn to other methods to stay hopeful and to train their minds. So I just found that incredible. Now, Venerable Trajan often says too, when she talked to, in the past, right, they would ask Lama Yeshe, like, "Are you angry that the Chinese took over your country?" And Lama Yeshe would say to them, "Oh, they just mean well, dear." "They just mean well." And Venerable was like, "What? What do you mean they just mean well? These people came and, you know, chased you out and took over your country." But Lama Yeshe was saying, you know, often people just want to be happy and not to suffer, right? They have motivations that they're not clear about. They think they're doing something beneficial. Like all of us have, we think we're trying to help or do something beneficial, but actually we're harming others because we're not clear of our motivation. And so he had this huge heart, you know, that he didn't hold on to any anger or hatred towards people who were harming him. Or same for His Holiness, right? People ask him, "Are you angry?" And he says, what good is being angry? I'm just not going to sleep well and be unhealthy. That's not going to help the Chinese-Tibetan situation. So, you know, the anger is not productive. But that doesn't mean that I don't say anything, because His Holiness is clearly very vocal about the Tibetan situation and that the Tibetans want to have their own autonomy. Yeah. So yeah, that was a big piece of what inspired me about the Buddhist practitioners, because you could see, wow, they were putting what they were teaching into practice. So, you know, that's something to aspire towards. Like, we have these living examples. But that shouldn't make us discouraged in our daily lives. Yeah, where you wake up with a lousy mood, and that's what we have to practice with, right? Okay, feeling kind of crummy today. Start with being quiet. Don't yell at anyone. Go to my meditation cushion. See what's going on. You know, how can I take care of myself? And that's actually a really big practice. Before you reach out for the chocolate chip cookie at breakfast, feel crummy. Feel crummy. You shut up. You know, instead of doing something on automatic, you're saying, "Hey, let's get quiet. Let's see what's going on. How can I help myself? How can I help others?" And that's how we grow our minds to become so strong one day, like His Holiness, or such that someone yells at you and you're like, "Okay, gonna be quiet. I'm gonna work with this and see what I can do about it." Yeah. So build that muscle slowly over time.
Kind of with my mom, she has dementia, so mm-hmm. every time she repeats herself, and it could get to the point where I get pretty aggravated. So she could be like, "Oh, let's go eat," and she already ate, and I'll be like, "You already ate, Mom." She's like, "No, let's go," and I'm gonna try to take a nap or something.
she'll come into my room and she'll be like, oh, let's go get something to eat. And I get angry at myself and I figure out that that anger comes from my mom and telling me all these, like, let's go, let's go. And so I have to, like, take a breather and I have to, like, kind of, you know, sit on it and kind of think about why am I getting mad at this, you know. And as soon as I figure it out, I kind of let it go. And it took a little while for me to kind of, I guess, be in that level. But when I did figure out, you know, why I was getting so angry at her is because of her condition. It's not because I hate her. It's not because of any other reason. It's just because she has that mental condition. And I learned to accept that, and now I see myself kind of, like, I guess, training my mind to not get aggravated all the time with her, you know. So I do have that little growth that I see in myself, and I always tell myself, you're doing good, you know, just keep doing that. And soon you'll learn to not get aggravated all the time. So, yeah, that's something that I'm incorporating. So,
yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's very powerful, and that's exactly where we start. With whoever we are, with whoever's around us. That reminds me of how I practiced with my mom in a very different situation. But too, that was also what got me going in my practice, where when I first met the Dharma, I think I was also very idealistic and interested in benefiting the world, and I was volunteering with a lot of low-wage migrant workers. And so I had, you know, certain ideas about how to help. Yeah, the government should do this. Or they should change these policies and we have to do XXX, yeah, certain external things I wanted to see happen. And then I went to Buddhist class, and one day the teacher said to me, you know, it's really great that you have these ideals, you want to benefit the world, you want it to be a better place. And he said, but is there peace in your heart? Is there peace in your house? Is there peace, like, in a 1 kilometer radius of where you live? And that really shocked me at the time, because I was arguing with my mother every day. I could not get out of the house without saying some smart comment to just show that I'm an adult now and leave me alone. I will wear what I want. You know, I was like, oh, here I am trying so hard to do something beneficial in society. But I was so angry all the time. And I wasn't kind to the person I live with. You know, I was like, whoa, big wake-up call. So I stopped fighting with my mom. That was the first thing I did as a Buddhist. It's like, you win. Yes, I will wear what you want me to wear. That's fine. It's not going to kill me. I don't want to fight with you because you're my mom. I love you. Right? And then she was very shocked. Like, what happened? Who took this angry child away, right? And she was like, okay, I guess going to temple has a good effect. You can continue going. You know. And then the amazing thing is, then she had time to look at her own anger. You know, because it takes two to fight, right? It's like, I stopped fighting. I was like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, you know, I'll come back early. I'll have dinner with you. That's fine. I love you. Okay. There's no one to fight with in the house anymore. And then she got to see, oh, I'm carrying all this anger. She used to have a very high-stress job and, like, yell at people in the house. And I think when all of us stopped fighting with her, she also relaxed. She started to do yoga. She told me she would go to yoga and cry and start healing from her past emotions. I was like, oh, okay. And now she's, like, a totally different person. She doesn't yell anymore. Like, very calm. So, yeah. So that was also what inspired me to keep going, to see, wow, me changing my behavior allowed her to have that space. You know, I didn't actively think I must change my mother's anger or I must shift, I must benefit. But just by seeing that the peace starts here and in our day-to-day interaction, it transformed our whole relationship and our lives. Sorry, Aidy, you had something?
Oh, it's because I have been thinking something and you gave me the right example. Sometimes, obviously, it takes more than one to get me to complain, I guess. And I don't think they just let you live. It is not who win, no? But just giving the other person the reason, and they say, you know, you want me blue sweater, I will wear blue sweater. No, it's because I don't want. So giving the other person the reason, it doesn't work either, because still I'm doing something that I don't want. And like when I was a teenager, I have to force in such a way or use things that I don't want it. And when I could say no, I say, you know, I will no, because here I don't want. And if you want to be angry with that, it's fine. So that means that I have to change something too, just to let the other person. But I mean, what happened with this person? They don't want to go into something they don't want to, just because it means to get this complaint, get to stop, no? I feel like something is still missing there. Mm-hmm. If I just do what other people want to, so we don't get complaints. So it's a good, sweet way for just one, and not for both sides.
So that's a very big question. Right, because what I'm hearing is you're saying, and I would say it comes back to our motivation again, right? Like you're saying, okay, someone wants me to do something. I don't want to do it. Do I just do something to make them happy? Right, so what do you think in terms of the motivation? If you just put on the blue sweater to make mom happy, you're still angry, right?
Resentment. I hate this sweater. I love you.
Yeah, so the motivation's still mixed, right? You're trying to please them, why? So they won't complain. So they'll get off your back. So you don't have to deal with them anymore. Yeah? So yeah, the motivation's still mixed there, and I think a lot of us can fall into that kind of, you know, Venerable calls it people-pleasing behavior. Oh man, there needs to be a recovery group for people pleasers. Yeah, I worked on this a long time, where, you know, because it's so tricky, you think you're doing something to benefit others, but really it's just your self-centered thought. Yeah. Oh, I want to be loved. I want to be liked. I want them to stop complaining about me. And the only, what we've all discovered, I see the nodding heads, is that when we act with that motivation, it doesn't actually make us happy. Does it benefit the other person?
Not really. I think it makes it very clear that I can do X, Y, and Z for you, that you'll say if you do this, I'll be happy, and I can do it, and you're still not happy. Mm-hmm. So that I think it comes down to that I can do exactly what you want me to do out of that sense of obligation or people-pleasing, but it still doesn't make either of us satisfied. Whereas if I can come back to, I'm not going to respond to your poke at me because I know that it's going to bring both of us unhappiness and I want us to be happy, then I can not respond, or I can do something that I don't particularly want to do because I can see the benefit that it brings. Even if I don't particularly want to wear that green fuzzy jacket you bought me, I'll wear it because I know that doesn't really matter and I get peace of mind and it brings you peace of mind. As opposed to, oh, I'll do it because it makes you happy. Because I've my own experience. I've tried to do that, and it doesn't make the other person happy. And then that expectation, that's when my own resentment grows, and then my resentment makes the other person knows. It's, yeah.
So it's tricky on both ways, right? Internally, yeah. So it all comes back to what our motivation is. And also, number two, we actually cannot make other people happy. That's the like crazy piece, right? Sounds crazy, maybe. You know, that's another core of the Buddhist philosophy, is our minds and our motivations are what makes each of us, brings each of us happiness or suffering, our own internal experience. So I may be a condition for someone else's experience, but how they decide to receive it, their feelings about it, I actually don't have much control over that. And guess what? Just like us, who have a hard time being satisfied, it's the same for the other person. Yeah, you wore the blue sweater today, but what about tomorrow? Can you also wear those red socks? And by the way, will you also do this for me? And you know, it's like, whoa, it's like a bottomless list, right? Like, where is it gonna stop? Then we get frightened, and you're like, yeah. Yeah, but we see that in ourselves and in others too. And so when we thinking that we can make others happy, it really becomes a trap, I think, if we're coming with that motivation. As opposed to, like Venerable Lamsa said, if we have maybe a bigger view, and we see, okay, this is what's beneficial for myself in this situation, what could benefit the other person, and that's what I'm going to try to do, looking at us both in this situation, looking at a bigger view, then we come at the situation from a very different angle. And we'll do things that surprise us. Like really, you know, I used to be so fashion conscious, I really would never have worn anything my mother asked me to wear. It's so ugly. But it just came to a point where I started to appreciate that she bought me clothes. It's like, oh, she's being kind. Okay, sure. And I don't actually want to think too much about what I'm wearing to work, so sure, I'll wear it. You know, it's my mother's being kind to me. And I can wear it to work, it's fine. So it was a shock for myself at the time. Oh, here I am in clothing I never imagined. But, you know, so from your motivation, you'll find yourself doing things you might not have expected. But because you know they benefit yourself and others, you'll do them. And I think it gets really subtle. Just coming back to these three motivations we try and wake up with every morning, yeah? I just read this morning His Holiness's book with Venerable Children. It's called Approaching the Buddhist Path. And he was talking about how even with that first motivation, not to harm, you can have four ways of doing it. I was like, oh, really? You know, so it gets more and more subtle. So he was saying, often in common society, what is the reason why we don't harm others?
To not go to jail,
right. So totally from a self-serving perspective, I don't want to get punished, okay? But around that is, maybe if I don't get caught, it'll be okay. Yeah. But at least it prevents us from, you know, harming others. That's level one, right? And we can see that that's kind of still can be a shaky motivation, yeah, as long as I don't get caught, or let's find a way to game the system, and yeah. And it's again, sometimes you see people don't actually believe in the law, right? But they're just afraid of being punished. So okay, whoever's more powerful calls the shots. So for now, I'm just not gonna harm. But if someone else is in power and they say it's okay, good, then I'm gonna do it. Yeah. So that's level one. Then going further, are people who decide not to harm because they see that it has longer-term consequences, it brings harm to themselves. Right? So sometimes that could be from a religious point of view, like, oh, if I harm others, I might go to hell. Right? Or if I harm others, they'll harm me back. Right? So that becomes like an ethical motivation. You see, oh, harming others has consequences. But again, it's still focused on the consequences to myself. Yeah, harms me, so let's refrain from that. Then he's saying, going a further level, where we actually think others want to be happy. Like me, they don't want to suffer. So if I harm them, that harms others and also doesn't benefit myself. So, you know, starting to extend our view to see, oh, harming others is actually not bringing joy to them and they are just like me. So I don't want to do that. I have empathy for other beings. Then he was saying the highest motivation that we try and work towards is the motivation that thinks, if I harm others, that impedes my potential to become fully awakened. Yet, as a human being with a mind that can be developed infinitely, you know, with all these incredible good qualities that a Buddha has, if I start harming others, it's creating the opposite. Right? I'm moving in the opposite direction. I'm not creating good connections with beings. They're not going to want to turn to me for support. So that's why I'm not going to harm people. But wow, so just even for that one, you know, not to harm, there's so many ways we can put that into practice. So that's part of all our individual journeys. You know, we're all at different places in our practice. The important thing is to see what works for us. And I think these three motivations we can come back to again and again because they encompass the entire Buddhist path. These three motivations every morning. You know, at the most foundational level, we try not to harm, for a start, with a self-centered motivation. That, you know, when we do the stages of the Path to Awakening meditations, right, the Lam Rim meditations that you're doing every morning, they are sequenced in terms of our motivation. Yeah, starting with the motivation of someone who's just concerned about their own welfare for a start. But you know, that's already a big step. Do you see a lot of people in your life who don't even know what their own welfare means? Or maybe yourself, do you do things that are actually not beneficial, but you can't stop? Yeah, right? And that's also, again, out of habit, right? Like, oh, I'm so upset, I'm just going to go drink something right now. Go to sleep. Or, you know, yell at the dog. Yeah. So, for a start, to even get clear, like, hey, what brings me happiness? What would be beneficial? Not just at this moment, but maybe in terms of longer-term consequences. Even the thought, if I harm someone, that brings harm to myself later, is actually a big step in our spiritual practice. So that's just the first motivation, not the harm. And then slowly, slowly, we start to expand it to others around us. You know, what's going to bring them benefit? And then thinking extremely long-term of how do we benefit others, not just in this life, but in future lives, in all possible universes and lives to come. That's our potential. And to think of moving in that direction. Yeah, so that's how, you know, the three motivations are our entire practice and the entire path that we can keep coming back to. So, since we've been talking so much about what's going on inside, I thought too to talk about, okay, maybe before we move there, are there any questions or comments?
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet? So I thought to flip it around as well. Because, you know, the Tibetan word for a Buddhist is an inner being, yeah, a nangpa, someone who looks at the mind. Yeah, who turns inwards, like we said, instead of always trying to look for something outside. Then don't you wonder, then why do these Buddhists have all these things? Like, what's going on here? We say that our experience is internal, we're working with our motivation, we're trying to look at why we do what we do, and to transform that, right, so that our minds can be happy no matter what's happening outside. Then, why do we need a meditation hall? What's up with the statues? What's up with the bowing? Why? Any thoughts?
I think it's just different tools to calm our mind or learn the Buddhist teaching. Because by bowing, I mean, Eddie, pardon me. Will you do that? You wouldn't, right? Because I don't have the quality that you will want to bow to me. But the Buddha and the Bodhisattva have the quality that, you know, I mean, not the form of circle that bow, but I mean, assuming I sit on a high chair and say, bow to me, you wouldn't do it. But you bow to the Buddha, you know. And the Buddha is, sorry, just at this moment, just a statue, you know, just don't even respond to you, to your bow. Help you to put yourself down and not think that I'm the mighty one. It's just a tool, and, you know, of course there are other respect and things like that, but that's how I look at it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. That actually, so all these external objects are just different tools, because we are externally focused beings. So even in all the practices that we do that say, you know, visualize this thing outside of you, but you notice it always comes back to your crown of your head and dissolves back into you, right? But so we're using the external world as tools to help us to support the transformation of our mind. And you'll see that every Buddhist tradition has developed these tools in different ways to cater to beings of all kinds of backgrounds and dispositions. And so you see in some traditions, maybe in, I think, Chinese Zen or Japanese Zen, like, lots of dark colors, right, very simple. The environment is meant to help the mind to focus on maybe just the breath or analysis. Yeah, so a lot of external distraction is gone. They meditate facing the wall, yeah, to help the mind to focus. And Venerable Tarpa's theory, and I don't know if it's been written about, but I believe it might be true, for the Tibetans, they were nomadic culture. Yeah, so they live in huge desert landscapes. Sometimes you build tents in the middle of nowhere, you just see mountains and sky. For days and days, that's all you see. You know, it's beautiful, but a harsh environment. So when they built their temples, they made them incredibly beautiful, like filled with the most magnificent, beautiful things you could imagine. So you try and imagine, you know, a nomadic people's, when you get to the temple, it's like, whoa.
I want to be there.
Yes, unbelievable, inspiring in that way. Yeah, and I think too, in the deserts, they used to like paint giant murals and things and put them up on the rocks of the mountains so that nomads passing by would be like dazzled and inspired by these holy images. Yeah, so they used the tools in that way. Whereas in another culture, maybe it's very busy outside. So you come into the temple, you want it to be simple, quiet, help the mind to focus. Yeah. So that's one way to think of it. So all the practices we do are tapping on our, you know, we're beings that reach outwards. So these are tools that help us deal with that. Yeah, we reach outwards, not for the chocolate cake, but for compassion and wisdom. Something a bit different. So I thought to talk a bit about what we see here in the meditation hall, and then if there are any questions about that, we can, you know, keep discussing as well. So yes, as Lingpo was pointing out, every altar will have a Buddha statue. Right, this is the Tibetan representation of Shakyamuni Buddha. And when you study the scriptures, I don't actually know this topic very well, but back in India, they said a great man had 32 marks and 80 signs. Which way around is it? Marks and signs, right? Yeah. So each one represents a particular quality. When we were studying the Nagarjuna's precious garland, which is this great text, it talked about how, you know, to even have one hair curl of a Buddha, you have to have, I think, like hundreds and thousands of years of merit to get the one hair curl. So the idea is that each and every part of the Buddha, and, you know, it's a body made of light that we're imagining, not some flesh and blood body that's, you know, producing a lot of waste and dirt. And yeah, that every single mark and part of the Buddha represents some good quality that he's worked a tremendous amount of time to cultivate. So it's a skillful tool to remind us of all the qualities we want to develop as well. Like whether it's the, you know, the head protrusion that represents his enlightened activities. Yeah, I think the long ear lobes representing the long life or wealth. Yeah, you know, in the past, the princess wore big jewels, so the Buddha removed those but has the long ear lobes. Yeah. So one way is when we reflect on the Buddha's body, it helps us to bring to mind all the things that he did to accomplish this present state, and to know that we can do the same too. Yeah, that there is something beyond a body that's producing waste or out of our control or, you know, gets sick, old, dies. Yeah, instead, we can create the causes to have a body that's constantly benefiting beings. So every altar will have a representation of the Buddha's body. Right, yeah, see the earth-touching gesture on the lotus throat. And every altar will also have representations of the Buddha's speech. So this is what you see up here. These are the Tibetan holy texts. They're called pichas. Yeah, and they were carved on wood block and printed with ink. So it's very hard for me to imagine in the past, you know, how people carved every single piece of wood with all this backwards, right? So that you could print it the other way. So this is the entire canon of scriptures spoken by the Buddha and then the commentaries on them. And we're very fortunate that people have kindly offered these to the Abbey. So I don't know how to put them back, so I'm not going to open one. But they're all individual loose leaf printed on both sides of Tibetan texts. Yeah. So all the teachings are in there. And then there's always a representation of the Buddha's mind. In this case, a stupa. This is a representation of the Bodhgaya stupa where the Buddha attained awakening. So the stupa represents the Buddha's mind. So that's what we're bringing to mind when we... That's the most basic element of any altar that we bring to mind, you know, representations of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. And then we're also very fortunate that people have given us many, many different holy objects. All right, but before we go there, yeah, too, so every day you notice the nuns come in and make some offerings on the altar. Yeah, so in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we offer 7 bowls of water, largely because water is easy to access and it's not something too expensive. Yeah, and it represents purity or cleanliness as well. And there are many ways to think as you're doing water bowl offerings. Yeah. So we offer those. These are the traditional 8 offerings. that come from the scriptures. Like in India, during the Buddha's, the historical Buddha's time, people would make these 8 offerings to guests of water to wash the feet, water to drink, flowers, incense, lamps, perfume, food, and music. So in India, that's what you would traditionally offer to a guest that you respected very much. So that became adopted, where we would make these offerings to the Buddha. And each one represents different qualities or things we hope to accomplish as well. So for instance, the flowers, you can reflect on beauty and its impermanence. You're offering that. You know, you're offering ethical conduct. And the incense represents the fragrance of ethical conduct. Or you're offering the fruit of awakening, and so on. Yeah, so these are all tools. Yeah, Venerable often says, the Buddha is enlightened. He doesn't need 3 tomatoes. You know, like, he didn't work for 3 countless great eons to get 2 bananas every morning. It's like, what am I going to do with these bananas? So with the bowing, the making offerings, like Lingpo was saying, is a tool for us, yeah, to open our minds, to say, oh, I would like to cultivate compassion and I would like to be more respectful, you know. I'm not like, yeah, look at me, here I am, what do you have to tell me? Right? It's like, oh, please teach me. And let me now offer something that represents what I hope to accomplish as well.
Yeah. Actually, like flower, like what Barbara say, is really, because when you offer the flower, it's fresh, but over the next 2-3 days, it will just dry up and then, you know, it's just rotten. Mm-hmm. So that's basically, it's impermanent, it's life, you know, keep changing. We'll be sick, we'll die. And then the light basically is to dispel darkness. So Buddha's teaching will guide us through all the darkness, all the difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cause for wisdom also. Yeah. So the important thing to note is that, you know, Buddhists are not making offerings to a statue. Yeah, this is really a part of our practice. What we're trying to do is transform our minds as we do these different things, that we are keeping in mind qualities we want to develop, ways we want to grow as we do these external actions that are meant to support that. So in the back here we have 16 arhats. Oh, it's complicated to explain.
I don't know.
Okay, we'll talk about that later. And then we have representations of different types of Buddhas as well. So we have Amitabha Buddha, Vajrasattva, Green Tara, yeah, Tara, Manjushri, Maitreya. Yeah. So maybe you wonder, like, why are there so many Buddhas? What's going on there? Yeah. So different Buddhist traditions will have different emphases. Like, especially in the Theravada tradition that's practiced in Sri Lanka, Thailand, a lot of focus is on the historical Buddha, seeing the Buddha as a human like us who practiced and perfected certain qualities and became awakened. So a lot of focus on the historical Buddha. But in the Chinese and also the Tibetan traditions, there's much more interest in the qualities that these Buddhas embody. There's the idea that there are many, many Buddhas that are still here benefiting us. Because, you know, you work for 3 countless great eons to develop these good qualities. I don't think you would just teach for 40 years like this and disappear, right? You know, the Buddha is still here benefiting us in many, many ways, as long as we can connect to that. So ways we can think of these representations you see here in these tankas, these are all Buddhas with the same realizations. They're just physical ways of thinking of these good qualities, the embodiment of. So for instance, Manjushri, we would say, is the Buddha of wisdom. It's not like he only has wisdom and doesn't have other qualities. Yeah, same realizations, same qualities, but a lot of emphasis on wisdom. And when we meditate on Manjushri, that's the quality we're focusing on. We're thinking of developing wisdom in many, many different ways, whether it's in our speech or writing or our thought. Yeah. So, and then Maitreya is the Buddha of love. So that practice focused on meditating on Maitreya will focus on cultivating love. Yeah. And likewise for, we have the Buddha of compassion, right? Chenrezig with the 1,000 arms. So again, the physical embodiment. I like to think of these as like ways to bring abstract qualities to mind. You know, sometimes you say, think of compassion. I'm like, what could that look like? I don't know. But if you say, okay, think of a being with 1,000 arms reaching out to help the world, that's always witnessing whatever we're going through. Like, oh yeah, I can imagine compassion that way, you know, coming in that form. So yeah, the Buddha of compassion takes that form. We have Medicine Buddha. Every morning we say our praises to Tara, right? The 20 Tara and the 21 Taras. It's a female Buddha who focuses on enlightening activity. At the back, we see the Wheel of Life, describing how we cycle in cyclic existence. In the morning, the first thing that we do is the prostration to the 35 Buddhas. So that's a tanka you can look at more closely. That's what we're visualizing. You know, and the Buddhas in each row help us with different afflictions. This is the 16 great Nalanda Pandits, I think. Is it 16 there or more? 18 Pandits. Oh. I can't count.
It's 18, but includes the Buddha.
Yeah. Oh, includes the Buddha, okay. So these are the great Indian scholars and commentators, you know, many of whose texts we study. And then here we have what's called a refuge tree, which is this one is unique to the Gelugpa tradition, where we have the founder of the tradition in the middle, representing all our teachers, and all the figures in there represent all the different teachers in the lineage, everyone who's practiced and passed the teachings down. So when we take refuge, we think of everything that they've done to practice and preserve the teachings such that they have survived till today. Tonight we'll do our practice focused on this refuge tree, the Lama Shoga practice, where we think of the whole lineage and are making a lot of offerings. But most importantly, thinking of the qualities of enlightened mind. That's what's getting passed down. You know, it's not a Tibetan passing Tibetan down, a Chinese person passing Chinese down. These are qualities that all these teachers are practicing and developing and passing down to us in whatever language, in whatever form. Whether it's through scriptures, whether it's through statues and representations, whether it's through a mantra. These are all tools that they're passing down to us to help us to generate the same kinds of qualities and realizations. So that's what we're really reflecting on tonight. Yeah. It's not just about it's not a practice where you're worshipping a teacher. It's a practice where you're trying to connect with awakened mind or awakened qualities. That's a very brief 2-minute tour of, oh, and of course, a picture of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who is our spiritual guide. That's our 2-minute tour of the meditation hall.
The 16, we're going to return to that.
Yes, the 16 arhats. So I had some hesitation because we now have to explain what arhats are. So, and that could come back to our three motivations too. I don't know if you've heard that there are different types of paths and vehicles. Yeah? Yeah. So, in the Theravada tradition, right, and in a lot of the Pali canons of the Buddha's teachings, right, a lot of the disciples there were arhats. So these are practitioners who focused very much on becoming liberated themselves. They wanted to attain a state free from greed, hatred, and ignorance for themselves because they see how much suffering that causes. Right? Like all of us talked about this, when you're overwhelmed by the hatred and attachment, that mind that's just like, I want only my own benefit, it just gives us a lot of pain. Yeah, so these are beings that recognize that. And they recognize that this world is not bringing them any happiness, so they work very hard to become free of those afflictions. But their main focus is their own nirvana. Yeah. So it's like, this world isn't, like, this cyclic existence is suffering, I need to get out. So tremendous urgency, I need to create the causes to get out, I need to practice for that purpose, let's go. Yeah. So that you practice hard and become an arhat. Yeah. So that's one path, one end goal for some practitioners. And we call that the fundamental vehicle, or now it's called the Theravada as well. That's what practitioners are moving towards. But you'll see as you do the guided meditations on the stages of the path, that's seen as only a middling motivation. And so we talked about the levels of motivation, right? The first one being my own benefit. I just don't want to go to hell. I want to make sure that, you know, I create good causes, maybe for a good rebirth. We start there. And that's already a big step on our spiritual path. And then we find there are beings who say, that's not enough. I don't want to just have good causes life after life. I want to completely get out of this cycle of suffering. I want to move towards something called nirvana, a state where I'm not going to get reborn again under the control of ignorance, hatred, attachment. And then there are beings who say, that's also not enough. Why? Why is that not enough? Yeah, exactly. So, okay, that's great. I'm in nirvana. Peace out, friends. I don't think they're like that. They say arhats have tremendous love and compassion too. But they don't practice as long as the Buddhas do to accumulate all the causes and conditions to benefit countless beings.
So why are they there in the back there?
So let me finish with the bodhisattvas. So then there are beings who, like you said, really want to benefit others. Yeah, they're like, well, you know, I'm in cyclic existence having a hard time, but hey, everybody else is too. So is my mom. So is my dad. I can't just go off and be like, bye friends, right? Or as we reflected, so many people have been so kind to me. Surely I have to help them too. Right? So that's when we start entering the bodhisattva vehicle, where we reflect on how countless beings have been kind to us. Everybody is as close to us as our parents. So we want to also develop, as long as it takes, no matter how long it takes, to develop those qualities so that we can benefit them. And really that's what a Buddha's omniscient mind is about. He not only knows all phenomena, he also knows all the dispositions of beings and how to benefit them. So that's why people in the Bodhisattva vehicle train for a very long time with this intention. It doesn't feel long, I guess. It must feel very joyful. Like, you know, you're just accumulating all these causes to connect with beings of all kinds and benefit them. So yes, returning to the arhats. So it is said that these are bodhisattvas in the form of arhats, is what I understand. You know, they are the Buddha's great disciples who have continue to exist in this world to benefit disciples. So they may manifest and take the form of arhats, but they are also continuing to benefit in cyclic existence. So that's I guess the Mahayana reading of it, that these are beings who are bodhisattvas who have taken the form of arhats. Yeah, so their prayers to the 16 arhats still, thinking of them as great teachers who are still around benefiting and teaching whoever has the ability to connect with their good qualities. That's my understanding of the 16 arhats. I haven't actually studied much about them. But again, you know, you can think of all these figures as ways to inspire the mind. And all of us have very different minds. Yeah, you'll see, for some people, you feel a very strong connection to, say, the Buddha of compassion. I did. Like, that's what got me into Tibetan Buddhist practice. I used to only focus on the breath. I was like, what's up with all this stuff? But when I saw the Buddha of compassion, I thought, oh, wow. You know, thousand arms, thousand eyes. Wow, wow, wow. I just felt drawn to that practice. For some people, they're drawn to reciting mantras. Some people are drawn to different Buddhas, yeah, with different qualities. So it really depends on where your mind is and what works for your mind, yeah, to inspire it.
And they have, like, different names, right? Because I thought that one was, like, Avalokiteshvara. Is that just another name?
Yeah, so Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit name for the Buddha of Compassion. And then Chenrezig is the Tibetan one.
Okay.
And then yesterday we talked, the Kuan Yin is the Chinese one. Yeah, so it's the same meaning. Yeah, the hearer of the cries of the world.
What about Medicine Buddha?
What about Medicine Buddha?
You said Manjushri was the Buddha of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
Buddha of love, compassion, and liberation.
I think liberation? Well, Medicine Buddha, what do you think? Yeah, he's a Buddha of healing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, often people will do Medicine Buddha practice for people who are ill, or for themselves if they're ill. But you know, when we think about it, all of us are ill. Yeah, in some way or other, or suffering in some way or other. So that practice gets expanded that way, right? It could start with us doing the practice for a friend who we want to benefit, or our own physical ailment. But as you do the practice, it gets deeper, and you see, wow. I am ill with a lot of other things.
But the real medicine he delivers is the Dharma.
Yes. Yeah. Showing us how to be free of to truly be free of illness, you know, working with the mind, how to create the causes, not to have a body that gets ill again. So with everything in Buddhist practice too, right, it's like, it looks like one small little practice, but it can contain the whole path, like the three motivations you do. It's like, if you think deeply about it, everything's in there.
So you mentioned that Buddha has 84,000 methods, practice or methods. So is medicine Buddha one of the methods, or just an external illustration? So that means, did Buddha teach such that you can practice medicine Buddha's teaching and then become liberated and become a Buddha? How is that 84,000 method being documented?
Documentation. You know, sometimes I think, I don't know where the number 84,000 comes from. I honestly think it just means a lot. Because they'll say you have 84,000 afflictions. It's like, who counted, right? Like, do you have 84,000?
It's like levels of each one. It's not like, for example, anger has different levels.
Yeah.
I think that's where the number comes.
Yeah. But based on your question, if you're asking, did the historical Buddha teach the medicine Buddha practice? I don't think so, or I don't know. Like, it's not documented in the Pali canon. But we do have also the Mahayana scriptures that talk about other Buddhas and Buddha lands. So medicine Buddha is a Buddha.
No, but yes, he presented the Buddhas in a teaching.
Which one?
Buddha Shakyamuni presented the medicine Buddhas in a teaching in Vaishali, India.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, cool. Yes. I haven't done enough sutra study, but thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, good to know. The ones I've read are the Buddha talking about the historical past Buddhas. Yeah, not so much the Mahayana ones.
Yes.
But basically we can think of these, it's said that we are living in a fortunate eon of 1,000 Buddhas. Nearby here, there's a garden of 1,000 Buddhas. So, you know, just the idea that these are beings that each have actualized the path and continue to benefit us. And that one day all of us will become just like them. So we don't all become one Buddha, right? So whatever you practice, you become medicine Buddha maybe. You'll become Tara, whatever you wish to practice. Yeah.
I want to say something. Just don't laugh here.
We'll try.
Try hard. It's because since the first meditation on Monday is making us to think about Buddha in golden light. I don't know what, I didn't know the Buddha of medicine, and I don't know if the one day I have seen. Since that day, I only see the blue Buddha, and I was like, just get away. You are not the one that is supposed to look. But I cannot look the one that is in gold light. It just always came in blue, and I was like, who are you? What are you on my mind? Because I didn't hear about any other Buddhas in blue. And I was like, who are you? And I was keep looking, and I was like, is me making someone here? Or what is this about? And I was trying to go back to the Buddha in gold, and just keep coming in blue, and I was like, okay, just breathe.
So that commonly happens, but I would say, you know, so it sounds like you have some kind of connection maybe with medicine Buddha from past imprint or whatever, so you could study that to see if you do have a connection there. But we find it's often the case, it's just the monkey mind. You tell it to focus on something gold, and then it turns green, or orange, or whatever. You know, the mind just wanting to do its own thing. So you can just calm down and say, let's focus on the sense of a golden light body. Yeah, because the practice we do in the morning is focused on Shakyamuni Buddha. Yeah. It happens to us too. You do long retreat, you're doing mantra of one Buddha, and then your mind just switches to the other one, and you're like, and you don't even know. You're distracted, right? You're like, oh, I'm doing the wrong mantra. Whoops. Yeah.
But in that Tibetan statues of medicine Buddha, they are golden.
Also?
Yes, you can recognize him for the features.
Yeah.
I mean,
the mudras.
Yes, the mudras. And yes, but it's the statues are not blue. The statues are golden.
That's true. The one in Singapore, the very big one at Bright Hill Temple, is golden.
So I was really curious on the topic of Buddhists, because, like, you know, before, like growing up, before I had any idea, like, what Buddhism was or anything, like, I think, like, the Western culture kind of, I think they confuse, like, that lucky Buddha, like, you know, you go to the Chinese restaurants and you see that. Yeah, and so it's like, who is that guy? And then, like, what's, like, the story behind him, or is he really Buddha, or, like,
so the story, he's the Chinese representation of Maitreya, the Buddha of love. And the story I read was that there was a historical monk who did look like that, and then he got and must have done a lot of kind deeds to get adopted as the representation of Maitreya. But what I love is there is a Chinese poem about it. He's represented with a very large belly, because his belly is big enough to hold all the suffering of the world. So that's what the big belly represents. So similar, you know, anything, it's all symbology to help the mind. So here's the Buddha of love with this giant belly, and he's laughing also at the suffering of the world. Not in a cruel way, but like, gosh, this is what sentient beings put themselves through.
It's an illusion. Maybe he's thinking everything is an illusion. Or it's not real, and that's why he's laughing.
Oh, but we do suffer. It is real. Yeah. It's like an illusion. But our suffering is suffering, and I think he knows that. But yeah, but you see that, why do beings keep creating the same causes? You know, so he looks at the world and the crazy things we do, and you have to laugh sometimes. But I think it's a big, big belly of love and compassion to hold the suffering of the world.
Because I saw, there's this black statue down here too. No one's going to ask you guys about
that. Oh, of the Buddha, the Chinese Buddha of love.
Yeah.
But it's true, it's become incorporated into folk culture, so the Chinese will go and rub the belly for good luck and wealth. I don't think that's the cause of good luck and wealth. It's just the cause of your statue wearing down. So it's two pieces, So there was a historical monk, I think, who must have looked like that and was well-loved.
So it's like kind of like a disrespectful thing now that it's become that, that people are like, oh, rub his belly so you can have more money, or, I mean, is that, I don't know, that wouldn't be like a good, respectful way to see that statue, right? Like,
And people don't take offense. I mean, it seems to make people feel close to the Buddha in some way. But it's illogical. To think that rubbing the Buddha's belly will bring you good fortune. And that is one difficulty that has come up, I think, in countries where Buddhism is widespread. You'll see sometimes the tools have overtaken the actual teaching.
Kind of like the Christian or Catholic beliefs with the cross. They use it in forms of different... They use it to justify something, right? If they want to take something, they'll do that in the name of God, or that's what I'm taking it as to. They'll use the Buddha, like, well, I want money, but for all the wrong reasons. That's what I'm thinking.
So that's actually not the Dharma.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the actual external tool has lost its Dharma meaning and become worldly. Yeah, we see that in any religion, as you point out.
Like religious culture becoming popular culture.
That. So that's something to discern. Yeah, as you see, like, there are a whole bunch of Buddhas in the bar. Like, what's going on? You know, I've been to bars where they have Buddha statues. And, like, this is not the right place to put that. This is before I became a monastic. FYI. It's like, totally not. The Buddha is not encouraging us to drink, or totally not part of it. But it just becomes popular culture. So that's something to keep an eye out for, you know. So as you've learned what the teachings are actually about, then you are clear, and you can tell others too.
And if they keep clean, the Buddha, so that's one way to see them.
But a purifying the space.
Keep shining.
Did you have a question?
No.
I was going to say something about that. Because we found... I've been thinking about that a lot recently, because especially in Chinese Buddhist practice, like, sometimes there are very popular practices that were widespread for an illiterate population in China. You know, like, recite Amitabha Buddha's mantra 10 times and you will go to the Pure Land. But there are no Dharma teachings given around that. You know, so if you believe that, that you just say the Buddha's name many times, and that will be like you'll be born in a pure land, that's missing the point. Yeah, the Buddha never taught methods like that. Say X 10 times and Y will happen. Yeah, the fundamental teachings are always about our motivation, about keeping good ethical conduct. Those are what create the causes of our happiness and others' happiness. Yeah. So that's the fine print maybe that doesn't get taught. You know, recite the mantra and keep good ethical conduct. Right. Then you will have a happy outcome. Any other questions? So we'll do some short meditation to just digest what we heard, and then we'll do the dedication together. So again, let's just take a moment to reflect on what we've shared and discussed today. And just keep in your mind one or two things you think you'd like to put into practice or explore further. Again, let's rejoice that we spent this time together this morning, looking at ways to transform our minds, to continue to nourish our good qualities, and to keep coming back to our altruistic intentions, to achieve our full potential to be of benefit to all beings. We can visualize all the positive energy we've generated this morning as brilliant light at our heart, and visualize sending that out to the entire universe. You can keep in mind specific people or beings you wish to benefit. But especially to all the kind beings who contribute to the Abbey and make it possible for us to be here. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their sufferings. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.